Before I get going, there's a handout that was mentioned in a workers' meeting. If you don't have one, there's a couple ushers ready to pass those out. So just slip your hand up and I'll get it to you. If nothing else, you can put it over top of your Bible and it'll protect it from the drool that runs out. Appreciate the vote of confidence. All right, we're going to talk about history, as Pastor Dameron said. We'll look at some examples later, and that's what that sheet is for. We'll get to that. There's others we'll look at, but those quotes, I thought it'd be easier for you just to see them than for me just to read them. We're going to start in Acts chapter 17. History, at least a little exposure I've had in the secular world, is extremely aggravating. And as Christians, it doesn't have to be extremely aggravating. In secular history classes, at least a few I've been in, there's no absolutes. You know, it's you could think that I took a class about JFK, and you could think it was the mob, you could think it was the Texas oil men, you could think it was the Cuban people. You know, everybody was right, and it just drove me batty. All right, we have a Bible that's absolute and true and correct, and we don't have to float in that never land of everybody's opinion is good. I want to start off today looking a little bit at getting a proper view of history from a Bible perspective. There are lots of ways to view history. Some that have been brought up through the years, people suggest that it's just a big cycle. It repeats itself over and over and over again. And, you know, different names, different countries, different locations, but the same thing, repeated over and over and over again. Others have suggested, Karl Marx being one that's more famous, that history is just this record of a class struggle. All right, let me read you a quote from his book. "The history of all hitherto existing society is the history of class struggles. Freeman and slave, patrician and plebeian, lord and serf, guildmaster and journeyman, in a word, oppressor and oppressed, stood in constant opposition to one another, carried on an uninterrupted, now hidden, now open fight, that each time ended either in the revolutionary reconstruction of society at large or in the common ruin of the contending classes." A class struggle. We use that phrase today. Liberals like to bring up the classes and pit the rich against the poor against the rich and that type of thing. And that's not the right way to view history. It's not the right way to view politics either and government. But it's not the right way to view history. As Christians and as people who believe the Bible, we can look at history, and the term that I think fits is providential history. It is a record of what God has done. You probably have heard the almost a cliche-ish statement that history is His story. That really is the way to look at it. It's a record of what God has done. It's not just the cycle. It's not just the rich against the poor. It's a record of what God has done. His hand is in everything, orchestrating and working things out. Let's read here in Acts 17. We'll read a couple passages just to see this idea a little bit. Down in verse 24, this is Paul speaking on Mars Hill. "God that made the world and all things therein, seeing that He is Lord of heaven and earth, dwelleth not in temples made with hands, neither is worshipped with men's hands, as though He needed anything, seeing He giveth to all life and breath and all things, and hath made of one blood all nations of men for to dwell on the face of the earth, and hath determined the times before appointed and the bounds of their habitations." So you see there, God determined how long the nations will be there, the boundaries of their nations and that type of thing. It was in God's hand. God was in control. Flip back to the Old Testament, to the book of Esther. We can see another passage that indicates here God being in control. Really, it's not a new thought. We believe God is in control. He is all-powerful and all-knowing. We can also apply that thought to history. Esther chapter 4. We're going to jump into the story here when Esther is contemplating going before the king. And that really was a fearful thing. There were men stationed whose job was to kill anybody that came in, unless the king stopped them. It wasn't something where the king would say, kill her, if he just happened not to notice. she was getting killed. All right, so we're jumping into that discussion. Verse 13. Then Mordecai commanded to answer Esther, "Think not with thyself that thou shalt escape the king's house more than all the Jews. For if thou altogether holdest thy peace at this time, then shall their enlargement and deliverance arise to the Jews from another place. But thou and thy father's house shall be destroyed. And who knoweth whether thou art come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" We don't know. This might have been the reason why God put you here. God was working and orchestrating. It just wasn't a random series of events. Jump to Proverbs chapter 21. Another well-known verse, but it gives us the idea of God being in control. Proverbs 21, verse 1. The king's heart is in the hand of the Lord. As the rivers of water, he turneth it whithersoever he will. God directs the kings, the rulers. They're in his hand. God is in control. That should be a little bit of a comfort. We don't know what's happening in this world and in our nation, but it is part of God's plan. It might be God's plan for our nation to be destroyed, but we can have some comfort that this is God's plan. All right, God is in control. One more verse along this line, Daniel chapter 4, down in verse 34. Here we have the story of Nebuchadnezzar after he became an animal and lived in the wild and came back to himself. Verse 34. We'll just read it. "And at the end of the days, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up my eyes unto heaven, and my understanding returned unto me, and I blessed the Most High, and I praised and honored him that liveth forever, whose dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation. And all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing, and he doeth according to his will in the army of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth, and none can stay his hand or say unto him, what doest thou?" Here we had the proud Nebuchadnezzar force who recognizes that God is in control. Imagine asking God, "What are you doing?" We do that to our children. But God, it's a distant thought for us. The point is, God is in control of this. We don't have to fall prey to other ideas that are thrown out by Marx and others of class struggles and that type of thing. We can look at history and see, wow, this is how God orchestrated things. It wasn't random events. God was doing something. There are some times we can look in history and to me at least it's easy to see what God was doing. There's other times where, at least for me, I look at it and say, well, I don't know, but I trust God. And I'll give you an example or two of where I think we can see God working and orchestrating in history. One that comes to mind quickly to me is the Spanish Armada back in 1588. This is brought up a lot to illustrate this point. But if you're not familiar, Spain was the dominant nation in the world. Powerful, very, very powerful. The power in the world. And England was this little upstart that had left the Catholic Church. We had Spain, very, very Catholic, very powerful, and England, weak, Protestant. And Spain wanted to return England to the loving arms of the Catholic Church. That was the official reason. They also were mad at the English because they were attacking their treasure ships and taking money from them. But the official was to return them to the Catholic Church. So we had Spain here put together this very large fleet of ships, so large we called it an armada, about 130 ships, and sent that after England. And England meets this fleet of ships. And before the battle, England sent some fire ships, just some old junky ships. They put hay and stuff on them and lit them on fire and floated them down towards the Spanish fleet. You can imagine old sailing ships, the danger that would present. And the Spanish fleet was forced to move very rapidly. And to do that, they had to cut their anchors. They didn't have time to pull them all up. That comes in play in a little bit. So they cut their anchors, move out of the way of these fire ships, and then they have the battle. The English win. Surprisingly, caught them in a narrow spot where their ships could outmaneuver them. And then after the battle, a storm blew up. And who knows what the old sailing ships did in the storm. If you're near a coast, they would drop anchor and ride it out. And there we had all of the Spanish ships with no anchors. And they get smashed against the coast of Ireland And then one account talks about the Irish slitting the throats of anybody who happened to survive the shipwreck and getting onto the land. Okay, we can look at an event like that and say, wow, God was working. Here we had England. You can think of our history and the benefit that England was to, in our history. And here God was preserving and saving it. We can see God working, God orchestrating, God in charge. Okay, another example I thought of that might not be so pleasant, but I still think it's there. God's hand obviously is there. If you think back, if you're old enough, to the election of President Obama, the first one. I think we had this senator who nobody knew, gives a speech at the convention, runs for the presidency, beats Hillary, who was the forerunner. She was going to take it that time. Then we had the housing market collapse. If it had been a good conservative that won, we would say, wow, wasn't God working? And it's just as true that God was working. God was orchestrating. Now, in God's mind, it wasn't a surprise that morning. I think it was to the opponent that lost, but maybe not to, it wasn't to God. God was working. Okay, and that's the point. History is a record of what God has done. We can look at that, and we're not studying random events. We're looking at what God has done. All right. Before I leave that thought about history being a record of what God has done and what God is doing, this also applies to us. Right? It's not God just isn't moving nations. God is working in our lives. If you think about your life, you can see how God worked and did things. I enjoy looking back and thinking how God got me here. Right? It took my dad getting fired from his job to get me here. Right? I'm not glad my dad got fired, but I'm glad God got me here. Right? I can look back and see God working in my life. It's not just nations and important people. It's in our lives as well. Okay, so history. It's a record of what God has done throughout time. All right, continuing on with that thought, the next main point is, what is the key event? If God is in charge and doing all this, he's not waking up like Olivia might every morning and thinking, what am I going to do today? And just kind of whatever her fancy leads her to, she goes and does. God has a plan. And the very middle, the key event in that whole plan was Christ. Before that, we see Christ preparing the world, or God preparing the world for Christ to come. And after that, we see him spreading the gospel everywhere. That event, if you think of the significance of Christ's birth, his death, his resurrection, salvation, eternity, heaven and hell. That is the event. He talked about it in the Garden of Eden, through the Old Testament. Everything looked to that point. Christ is the middle of everything. Let's look in Galatians. Let me read you a verse there. In Galatians chapter 4. Oh, there's wrong verse. All right. But when the fullness of time was come, God sent forth his son, made of a woman, made under the law, to redeem them that were under the law, that we might receive the adoption of sons. When the fullness of time was come, when God had orchestrated and worked things out, he sent Christ to the earth at the right time, the fullness of time. Now, as people, we can look at the world at that time and see, wow, there's some things that were just right for God to send Christ at that time. If you're familiar with the Roman Empire much at all, it was right at the beginning of what's called the Pax Romana, about a 200-year period where as long as you were inside the Roman Empire, it was a pretty safe time. If you happen to be just across the boundary, it wasn't a very good time to be alive. But if you're inside the Roman Empire, it was a peaceful time. Christ came right at the beginning of that. If he had come 30 or 40 years earlier, it would have been the middle of the civil wars of Rome. You know, Mark Antony and Julius Caesar and all the confusion and strife that came out of that. Right at the beginning of this time of about 200 years of peace within the empire. Again, from a human perspective, we can see, wow, that's perfect. It gives the gospel time to spread. And it did. We can also see at that point Jews scattered all over the Roman Empire. So as the apostles and others traveled, there were people there who knew the Old Testament, and at least from a human perspective, should be the most ready to grasp Christ and understand and be saved, because they already understood the Old Testament. So we had them scattered all over. We see the apostles frequently going to the synagogues where the Jews met. One of the first places, those ready-made audiences scattered all over for the gospel to go to. We know the Jews, many of them traveled to Jerusalem at the time of Christ's death and Pentecost in that area, and heard about the gospel and then went back. And so we can see from a human perspective, wow, God was orchestrating and working and doing things there when Christ came. Okay, from that point on, I still think we can see God orchestrating and working to spread the gospel. Right? There are several passages that do this. We read Galatians already, to redeem them that were under the law. Back in Acts 17, which we read already, talked about that they should seek the Lord. God orchestrated things so that they would seek the Lord. 1 Timothy 2, I'll just read it, talks about how we should pray for men, for kings, that we may lead a quiet and peaceful life. For this is good and acceptable in the sight of God, who will have all men to be saved and come to the knowledge of truth. God here is working so that everybody has a chance to get saved. I mean, he promises there's nobody that's going to stand before God and say, I didn't know. This isn't fair. He provides that opportunity to everybody. Okay, so God is in charge. He's orchestrating. It's not some random, haphazard thing. We can see his hand there. We're humans. We don't have a perfect mind, an infinite mind like God, so we can't fully grasp it. But we can see God working and see what he's doing. Okay, so God is in charge. The next thing I want to talk about was the fact that the Bible, this book, is a historical, an accurate historical record. We can read things in the Bible, and if it talks about history, it's true. We hear that in science and other places, but it's also true about history. Historians and archaeologists and others for centuries have tried to claim that the Bible was full of errors. Right? And all those people, they make these wild claims about, you know, there's these people mentioned in the Bible that never existed. They're just made up. And then all of a sudden they trip across the city that the Bible says was there, or writings that talk about the people that the Bible says was there. It's true. Right? We don't have to cower in fear when someone says, oh, the Bible is full of error. Don't you know anything about history? No, it's true. Right? History always has to change and line up with what the Bible says, not the other way. Right? It's always going to, much like science does. They come up with some new thing in science. It never has to, the Bible doesn't have to change to accommodate science, but science is always coming that direction. And history is the same way. I want to go through some examples of things that people said were wrong about the Bible, and now we know they're true. Right? Before I do that, let me read you a quote. This is from 1894, a book called About the Bible, a poorly named book. At the time, these wanderers, talking about Moses and Israel, had no written language. They could neither read nor write. They had no means by which they could make this revelation known to the nation. It is now not only admitted by intelligent and honest theologians that Moses was not the author of the Pentateuch, but that all admit that no one knows who the authors were or who wrote any of these books or a chapter or a line. We know that the books were not written in the same generation, that they were not written by one person, that they are filled with mistakes and contradictions. Right, so that was the mindset. And that's still the mindset of lots of people today. There's just all kinds of contradictions everywhere. But we can go to the Bible with confidence, partly because of our faith in God, ultimately because of our faith in God. But also it's proven itself over and over and over to be accurate. All right, let's look at some examples. The first place I want to start with is some Bible or some dates of when things happened. All right, let me give you a couple, just some rough dates. Creation, about 4,000 B.C. The flood, 2348, that time frame. The Exodus, children of Israel out of Egypt. That didn't happen. If you listen to some people today, I just read an article today. There's no evidence of the Exodus, so obviously it didn't happen. But and according to our myths, it was 1491, King David, right about 1000 B.C., all those B.C. If you look at secular dates, you'll get things like this. Egypt being united under one ruler for the first time, 3400 B.C. It's pretty impressive. 800,000 years before the flood that happened. The pyramids, about 2500 B.C. before the flood that happened. The Sumerians, they do have them starting about 4000. So at least that's the earth was here for that date. There's all kinds of these, but some cave paintings in Africa I saw they dated at 10,000 BC. That's pretty good. You go back 6,000 years, and then another 6,000 years to the creation, and then another 6,000 years, and then we have those cave paintings done. Those are really amazing artwork to paint on caves that weren't there. If you look at secular history, there's all these crazy dates, and you can look at those and say, wow. Where's the problem? And the problem is with our dates. Right? The Bible gives us an accurate record. Right? And we don't have to cower in fear. In time, either they'll continue to believe a lie or they'll find something that shows they were wrong and they'll have to say, wow, I guess the Bible was right in that point. The main problem with their dating is there's two things in my mind that cause all their dates to be wrong. The one is they assume evolution. So they want a long time frame. So they're automatically going to stretch everything out as far as they can. They don't want to have everything starting 6,000 years ago because that doesn't fit with their thinking. So there's going to be that automatic stretch. And the other is they often use radiocarbon dating, which we won't go into the science of it, but it's very faulty. All right, David Cloud gave an example in his book. There in 1991, some thieves stole some artwork from some place that was new and ended up throwing it in the bushes. And people from Oxford came and discovered it and dated it as 1,200 years old using radiocarbon dating. Okay. And they're taking that scientific way to date things. And we shouldn't. It's not scientific. We don't have to have our fear shaken based upon that type of thing. So Bible dates, they're accurate. All right? You'll read often other places, and my wife, I drive her crazy. I'll look at a date and say, oh, that was before this or that was before that. And you can look back and say, well, that was before God made the world. Those people lived before the flood. It's kind of fun if you take a Bible timeline and look at the dates that are claimed by the secular world. They're wrong, and we don't have to worry about it. Okay, another historical thing that we can look at that is doubted, but there's lots of evidence for. The flood. The Bible claims there was a flood. There's lots of science evidence for the flood. I really enjoy looking at that. But there's also a lot of historical evidence for the flood. Let me read you a couple quotes. These aren't on our sheet. This is from a list of Sumerian kings. They're listing off different kings. And in the middle of it, it says, then the flood swept over. And after the flood has swept over, the kingship had descended, and it talked about the next king, right in the middle of this list of Sumerian kings. A Babylonian king was described as he loved to read the writings of the age before the flood. Right? Isn't it shocking that there'd be other evidence? It's not shocking. Let me read you a quote from Haley's Bible Handbook. He said, Babylonian, Assyrian, Egyptians, Persians, Hindus, Greeks, Chinese, Phrygians, Fiji Islanders, Esquimaux, Aboriginal Indians, Brazilians, Peruvians, and indeed every branch of the whole human race have traditions of a great deluge that destroyed all mankind except one family. All these myths are intelligible only on the supposition that some such event did actually occur. Such a universal belief, not springing from some intrinsic principle of our nature, must be based on an historical fact. Right? You can go all over the place, and all of the ancient cultures, they talk about a flood. Secular historians want to say, oh, you know, they all copied off each other. You know, somebody was the first, you know, maybe the Epic of Gilgamesh or something, and the Bible copied from that, and all these other people copied from that. That really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. The thing that does make sense is there was a flood. And it ends up in everybody's mythology and lore. Obviously, things get shifted and changed in those inaccurate records. But there's a flood, just like the Bible described. Right? We don't have to to wonder and say, well, I believe it, but I think it really happened. And there's historical evidence to back up our faith in God. Okay, another example. This was alluded to in a quote I read you, but people used to claim, and I used to claim, that Moses, or that writing was not invented till after Moses. Right, so he couldn't have written the first five books of the Bible. And, you know, this is a time of great illiteracy and that type of thing. So they say the writing wasn't invented, so all of that is obviously just fairy tales and all made up. People wrote it down years later. Complete fabrication. All right. Let me read you a quote. This is from 1896. The time of which the pre-Mosaic narrations treat is a sufficient proof of their legendary character. It was a time prior to all knowledge of writing. Right? So that was the claim. They couldn't even write back then. That was in a book called Old Testament Theology. Wouldn't have been a good place to get your theology. Right. Now, in recent years, late 1800s, early 1900s, there are thousands of examples of tablets and writing that predate Moses. I mean, thousands. We're not talking about one or two. Thousands. Libraries, things that talk about business transactions, talk about banking transactions, treaties between nations, medical documents, mathematical drawings, scientific drawings, they're just on and on and on. Thousands of these things. Okay, so we start with this guy. I'm sure he stood up straight and had his nose, his glasses on his nose and acted sophisticated, talking about how the Bible is wrong. And he's made out to be completely wrong. Right? There was writing, despite all the crazy claims. Let me read you a quote here. This is from 1904. The Babylonia of the age of Abraham was more, Abraham, way before Moses, was more highly educated than the England of George III. That's the time of the American independence. More highly educated than the England of George III. The Mosaic age, instead of being an illiterate one, was an age of high literacy activity and education throughout the civilized world. From one end of the civilized ancient world to the other, men and women were reading and writing and corresponding with one another. Schools abounded and great libraries were formed in an age which the critic only a few years ago dogmatically declared was almost wholly illiterate. Okay, so there's another example of a claim made against the Bible about how it was false historically. And we have proof now that, no, the claims were false. The Bible is true. All right, let's flip back to Genesis chapter 10, and we'll get another couple of examples. We'll get to the drill catcher here in just a second. Genesis 10, verse 8. And Cush begot Nimrod. He began to be a mighty one in the earth, and he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Wherefore it is said, even as Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord, and the beginnings of his kingdom was Babel. All right, so we have the name Nimrod associated with Babel. For a long time, people thought, oh, that's crazy. Who's this Nimrod? Right? Well, we now know from history and archaeology that ancient Babylon worshipped a god named Bel Nimrod. And it's not a big stretch to think, wow, that he must have made himself a god at some point. It wouldn't be the first place that made the king, or that where the king made himself God. Right? So we have the very name there, associated with Babel, just like the Bible said. If you look in verse 11, it's out of that land went forth Asher and built Nineveh. Exactly the same thing. Who is this Asher? You know, we never see that anywhere. Well, they worshipped a god named Asher. It fits with just what the Bible says. Right? People used to think that, or claim that, well, these people never exist. It's just a fairy tale, a bunch of, you know, names and places. Just like the Bible said, is the way we find it. Okay, another example that I thought was interesting deals with Pharaoh in Egypt. People used to criticize the stories of Joseph and Moses because they never gave any name to Pharaoh. It was always just Pharaoh, like the king, Pharaoh. No King John or something like that. Said, oh, these are just made up. They didn't know who they were talking about, so they just put some generic name. Well, now we know that was the proper way to address Pharaoh. They never addressed any. It was just always Pharaoh. It wasn't Pharaoh John. It was Pharaoh. So the Bible was following what was the standard way to address the king. It wasn't until about 1000 B.C. that they started to associate a name with Pharaoh. Can anybody guess what we see in the Bible at about 1000 BC? You can probably guess. A name. In 1 Kings 11, we see King Shishak from Egypt. First time that a name is tied with the king of Egypt, the Pharaoh. Before that, it's just Pharaoh. And again, secular historians looked at it and saw this pattern and realized, wow, they never put a name with it back then. And it knocked the legs completely out of this claim that the Bible is false and fraudulent and just myth. It lines up exactly with what we find in history. Shouldn't be surprising, but it is reassuring. This Bible, the book, is true. All right, next I want to look at the handout. These are some records from the kingdom of Assyria. And let's flip to those passages. I want to read the passage and then read the Assyrian record. And to me, it's an amazing similarity. The Assyrian records we find late 1800s, early 1900s. If I can get there. 2 Kings 15. Down to verse 19. And Pul, the king of Assyria, came against the land, and Menahem gave Pul 1,000 talents of silver, that his land might be with him to confirm the kingdom in his hand. Going down to verse 20. And Menahem exacted the money of Israel, even of all the mighty men of wealth, of every man 50 shekels of silver to give to the king of Assyria. So the king of Assyria turned back and stayed not there in the land. Okay, that was the Bible record. Now, hundreds and hundreds of years later, after people mock the Bible for being false, we come across this from Tiglath-Pileser, which was the, from what we understand, the more official name of the king. Much like popes or something, they assume a different name when they take their office. Tiglath-Pileser would have been that name. It says, as for Menahem, I overwhelmed him like a snowstorm, and he fled like a bird alone. He should write some political cartoons or something. Help us out. Fled like a snowstorm, or overwhelmed like a snowstorm, fled like a bird alone, and bowed to my feet. I returned him to his place and imposed tribute upon him. Just like the Bible claimed. It's me. It's amazing, but it shouldn't be. It should be what we expect to find. All right, look down at verse 29. In the days of Pekah, king of Israel, came Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, and took Ijon and Abel-Meth-Makkah and Jonah and Kadesh and Hazor and Gilead and Galilee, all the land of Naphtali, and carried them captive to Assyria. And Hoshea, the son of Elah, made a conspiracy against Pekah, the son of Remaliah, and smote him and slew him and reigned in his stead in the 20th year of Jotham, son of Uzziah. And here we have Tiglath-Pileser's account. That Omri, house of Omri, he's the guy who, the king who purchased Samaria and built the city. So referring back to that king, that's why Bet Omri is there, the Israeli king. Bet Omri, all of whose cities I had added to my territories on my former campaigns, and had left out only the city of Samaria. The whole of Naphtali I took for Assyria. I put my officials over the governors. The land of Bet Omri, all its people and their possessions, I took away to Assyria. They overthrew Pekah, their king, and I made Hoshea to be king over them. Again, just like the Bible describes. We see here in a completely secular account that was discovered hundreds and hundreds of years later than the Bible was written. All right, 2 Kings 18. Down to verse 9. And it came to pass in the fourth year of King Hezekiah, which was the seventh year of Hoshea, son of Elah, king of Israel, that Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up against Samaria and besieged it. And at the end of 3 years, they took it. Even the sixth year of Hezekiah, that is the ninth year of Hoshea, king of Israel, Samaria was taken. Let's do verse 11. And the king of Assyria did carry away Israel out of Assyria and put them in Halah and Habor and the river of Gozan. It goes on from there. Here's the record from the Assyrians. In the first year of my reign, I besieged and conquered Samaria. I should mention there, the Bible gives Shalmaneser. He was the king before Sargon. But it starts out that Shalmaneser went up and besieged it. And the next verse is, at the end of 3 years, they took it. So it does not specifically say that Shalmaneser is the one that took it. It says he started the reign, which would fit with the chronology of one king dying and the other taking over. So, in the first year of my reign, I besieged and conquered Samaria. I surrounded and deported as prisoners 27,290 of its inhabitants. From them, I equipped 200 chariots from my own army units. I restored the city of Samaria. I made the remaining inhabitants assume their social positions. I installed over them an officer of mine and imposed upon the tribute of the former king. I brought into it people from the countries conquered by my own hands. Okay, again, exactly what the Bible describes we have here in the records there. One more quickly, chapter 19, down to verse 36. Esarhaddon's account. Let me get to that chapter. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and went and returned and dwelt in Nineveh. And it came to pass, as he was worshiping the house of Nisroch, his god, that Adramalek and Sharez, his son, smote him with the sword, and they escaped into the land of Armenia. And Esarhaddon, his son, reigned in his stead. And here's Esarhaddon's account. Disloyal thoughts inspired my brothers. They rebelled in order to exercise royal authority. They killed Sennacherib. I became a raging lion. My mind was in a fury. These usurpers fled to an unknown land. The Bible tells us the land they went to. Okay, so again, these were claimed to be just made up stories. And then all of a sudden we find these inscriptions and accounts that line up exactly with the Bible. The Bible is true historically. All right, there's several more examples. Let me just mention a couple of these quickly. Hezekiah's tunnel. How many went through Hezekiah's tunnel? I was in front of Mr. Payton. I was glad I was on that side. It used to be thought it was just this crazy story. You know, the tunnel, what is this? This is make-believe. Until 1867, when they found the tunnel. Just as the Bible described. Belshazzar, he's the famous for the handwriting on the wall. Secular historians claim that he didn't exist. They knew the last king of Babylon, and it wasn't him. It was a guy named Nabonidus. All right? So there's, oh, the Bible's wrong. Look, right there. Well, we find out later that Nabonidus was Belshazzar's father, and they ruled as co-regents. And even just this afternoon, I was reading through the account again, and it struck my mind that Daniel was made the third ruler in the kingdom. There's already two. Made him third. So again, claim that this is completely false. And then we find out later that, no, that fits exactly with what history says. Pontius Pilate in the New Testament, he was thought to be completely fraudulent, never existed until 1961. When we found this inscription, not we, archaeologists, Pontius Pilate, prefect of Judea, erected the Tiberium to the August gods, the Roman gods. Right? Claimed he never existed. The Bible claimed he did. And then we find the artifact that supports it. King David. People thought he's a complete myth. In fact, this is still ongoing. But we found records that mention the house of David in 93. In 2005, they've started excavating his palace there in Jerusalem. Okay, people still want to doubt that. And they would say, oh, that's not what you think it is. All right, but it's the palace of David. Again, completely, they say it didn't exist. They say a king of his stature that did all the stuff that the Bible claims it did, there would be records of it. So he obviously is fake. Right? But we know he wasn't. All right, so there's lots of those. I tried to pick out some that I thought were interesting and easy to point out. Let me point out two more things here. One, some things where today people are looking at the Bible and saying, oh, it must be false. Look at this stuff. I don't point these out to shake your faith, but just to say, it's never going to end. Right? Ultimately, we believe the Bible because of faith in God. Right? It's never going to end. So when you come across these things, you don't have to wonder, oh, maybe this is the one that's going to undo everything. It's not going to happen. All right, there's people that claim that there were no camels ridden at the time of Abraham. There's nowhere in the Middle East. Didn't happen. Okay? There are people that claim the Exodus never happened. Complete fraud. They claim that the Jews lived in Israel the whole time. They never left and came back. Didn't happen. The Canaan conquest never happened. One book said, it is a story which, as it is presented in the Bible, definitely never happened. All right, the Canaan conquest. Some of us were in. Anyway, there's evidence for it if you want to have your eyes open. People claim that there was no united kingdom at all under Saul, David, and Solomon. Complete fraud, complete myth. They say it was invented hundreds of years later by somebody who's wanting to give the Jews some sort of national identity and an excuse to get them all together in one nation. Never existed. Okay? It's not going to stop. People are always going to point to the Bible and claim that it's false. We don't have to let that shake our faith. It is true and accurate, even in its historical record. Okay? Let me close by just kind of making a couple points of application to how this can affect us. The first one I have is, are we fitting into God's plan? We talked about how since the time of Christ, he's spreading the gospel. Are we fitting in? How much of that plan are we participating in, telling others about Christ? We talked about how God has a plan for us. How much are we seeking and following that plan? He does have a plan. We should seek to follow it. We can have renewed confidence that this Bible is true. We don't have to let scoffers and others shake our faith. This book is true. We can pick it up and read it and know that it's from God. We're not going to, at some point, realize we followed a fable. It's true. Renewed confidence that it's true. The warnings, the blessings, hell, salvation, heaven, it's true. We can have confidence. And then the last thing is, we don't need to be intimidated. When we read accounts, when we see articles in a newspaper, we don't have to be intimidated. We can have faith in God. The Bible is true, even in its historical record. All right, let's go ahead and pray and end the message.